From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On Saturday, the Italian Coast Guard rescued 1,800 immigrants in the middle of the Mediterranean. Five people in that group were found dead. Meanwhile, the French and British governments are working together to try to stem a crisis in the northern French city of Calais, where approximately 3,000 migrants fleeing war and poverty are attempting the dangerous and illegal crossing to Britain. 2015 has been the year of the migrant in Europe, with approximately 137,000 asylum seekers arriving in the first half of the year alone. This hour, On Point, the migrant crisis in Europe and the limits to sanctuary. You can join us online or on air. What's the moral obligation here? Can Europe really take all of these people in, and does it have that moral responsibility? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Paris is Colette Davidson, Paris correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She was in Calais, France back in June. Colette Davidson, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
So, Colette, since you've been there, and we're going to be talking a little bit about the geography, in a way, of what's going on in Calais, take us up in a helicopter ride. We're talking about thousands of migrants from around Africa and the Middle East converged basically on this one port town, all trying to get somewhere else. Because what's there in Calais? Explain the situation to us.
Well, Calais itself is a pretty small working-class town. There are around 30,000 people. But, you know, as you can see, if you enter Calais, the migrant situation is really prevalent everywhere you look. You go to the train station, you can find maybe a group of five or six migrants coming back from the day of trying to cross at one of the various border crossings. You go into the town and you might see a few people sitting around, or you go to a cafe and you might see another group crossing the town. There are various points throughout the town where people are trying to cross at the Channel Tunnel and also at the ferry crossing. So you have, these are on opposite ends of the town, so you have people making that trek. They might try one crossing in the morning and another crossing in the evening. So you'll see these, you know, small groups just walking across, or some people have found bikes to cross the town to make those crossings. And then the camp itself is kind of on the outskirts of town. It's not right in the center of the town, but it is quite the sight to see. There are around 3,000 people there now, and while most people are living under, you know, let's say tarpaulin tents held up by sticks, there are others who have very elaborate tents that they've put a lot of thought and effort into, because some of these people have tried and failed or been kicked out from the UK. And so they're staying in France for a while. They don't want to make that crossing anymore. They're tired. And
wow.
So there's a lot of waiting going on.
It's just an amazing scene, and there are a lot of clips of it online and on YouTube at the moment. And, you know, a lot of them shot at night, when it seems that a lot of the attempts are made to climb fences and to break through barriers. Let's listen to a 20-year-old Pakistani student named Omar Shakhtar. He was in Calais last week, and he spoke with NPR about why he was trying to hop on a truck to the UK. And this is after it took him 6 months to get to Calais.
We come from Pakistan, get to Iran, Turkey, Greece, Bulgaria, Romania, after Italy, and get to France. I really have bad life there in Pakistan. It's a dangerous life there. I want to be free life. I want to be better life, like other humans, like staying in Europe.
Colette, to some degree, he just answered the question I was going to ask you, but what is it that all of these young men, and I understand it's mostly young men, what are they running from, and where are they running from?
Well, there are economic migrants, there are people that are fleeing violence, and then there are those who have made various crossings already. A lot of people have already been to Italy, Greece, throughout, you know, Spain, and now they're in France. And as I've heard from some local volunteers, a lot of people are charting their journey as they go along.
Mm-hmm.
So they may not have thought of going to the UK from the beginning, but as they go along, they find there aren't any jobs, They're not being welcomed. Here in France, a lot of people are finding that it's very difficult to get their papers processed. They're waiting for months or even years to get an answer. And so then they start hearing about what's going on in the UK. There's an allowance, a living allowance. There's a small, I think it's £36 per week. There's also accommodation if you are an asylum seeker. So people are hearing these stories and kind of crafting their journey as they go.
And £36, let's just clarify, is about $60. I mean, it's not as though there's loads of money on the other side. But you did answer the question, why the UK? So the story is out among the migrants that right now Britain is the most welcoming place that they could get to. Is that right?
Well, that is what people are hearing, and whether or not that's true, you know, a lot of people have written about this in recent months, about what are the facts, and when it comes down to it, the difference in that welcome is slight. France is also known for having a great social system, so some might be surprised that people are trying to flee France to go elsewhere, but I think the jobs is the thing that I heard the most when I was speaking to people in the camp. Was that they're in France and they're trying to get work or they're trying to get papers to work, and there are no jobs. And so I think that's what a lot of people have found that were in Italy and Greece, is that there were no jobs there, and so they couldn't really get anywhere. And I think a lot of people have this idea that in the UK there are jobs. So regardless of whatever else happens, as we know, a lot of people will probably not apply for paperwork. Some of these people that get to the UK will remain illegal and, you know, find under-the-table work. But at least the rumor, at least, whether that's true or not, is that there are jobs in the UK.
And the lengths to which people are willing to go to get to the UK, the literally the physical risk that they're willing to take, are extraordinary. They're hopping on the tops of trucks that are going over on ferries, and there are photographs at the British side of these trucks pulling off with men clinging to the top. And then there's the whole issue of the Channel Tunnel, the train tunnel that goes under the English Channel. It's 32 miles long, and people are trying to stow away on trains, a lot of them clinging to the outside. And this is dangerous stuff. Here's a report last week from the BBC. This man was a migrant from Pakistan, and he watched his cousin fall off a train and die. He recounted this to BBC reporter Paul Adams.
The train is very fast, very fast. They leave the handle, and they head the concrete wall.
He hit a concrete wall?
Yes, hit the concrete wall.
Were you with him at the time?
Yes.
You saw this with your eyes?
Yes, I saw.
Yes.
I also tried to take a train, but we left when we saw my cousin.
And so you stayed with him?
You stayed with him.
I'm really sorry.
It's okay.
What was his name?
So said Sadiq Hussain from Sadiq. Pakistan.
Coletta, you're hearing a lot of stories like this in terms of the risks that people are willing to take.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's an extremely dangerous journey. They're hopping onto parts of the train where they could be easily electrocuted. And not only in Calais, there was a young man in the Gare du Nord in Paris who was also electrocuted by trying to hop on the top of a train, on a Eurostar train. So that's probably the number one way people are losing their lives, as well as falling off and or getting hit by cars. I mean, there's a lot of traffic of different means of transportation just in that Channel Tunnel area. There are car shuttles, there are trains, there are trucks. So it's very dangerous. And then, of course, this electrocution issue, the electricity on the rails.
Now, what is happening on the British side of the channel in terms of this massive traffic jam that has developed over the last several days? Why did that traffic jam form, and who's in it?
I believe you're speaking about Operation Stack.
Yes.
Yes. So, I mean, the trucks are lined up to try to protest this situation and to say that we will not, you know, stand for this. There's a lot of anger on both sides, and I think for the truck drivers, they feel that they're kind of the victims in all of this because of the fact that migrants can jump in or hide inside their trucks, and they're the ones that pay the fine. I think, you know, let's not start saying that the migrants are dangerous, but maybe some will take dangerous measures to try to threaten a driver to hide out in the truck. And so the truck drivers and the ones that I did speak to in France, are some of them are even avoiding the Calais region because of this situation, because they're afraid of what could happen. And then on the other side, on the UK side, people are getting fined if anyone is found inside their vehicle. So there is that risk as well.
And so what we have on the French side, guarding the ports and trying to block access to these to the train jumpers is basically the local police force. And let's hear from Calais Police Union head Bruno Noël.
We're living a dramatic situation. There are too few of us to deal with the growing numbers. We chase them away, and they just come back.
So what is the situation with the police? What tools are they using to control the situation?
Well, there have been more police officers, more gendarmerie staff brought to Calais. I think the number is now 550 on the ground. Mm. And, there's more and more money being allocated to what's going on in Calais and the police force in general. Just having more people on the ground and is one aspect. But the other aspect is trying to secure those borders. And as I spoke to one member of the police staff in Calais, one of the main struggles is the land mass. I mean, there's 22 kilometers of land surrounding the Eurotunnel area, so that's an extremely large, amount of space to try to block off from people. The existing fencing in some areas is rather flimsy. You could almost just jump over it. You wouldn't necessarily even have to cut through it. So that's something that they're really going to have to tackle.
All right. So this thing has a lot of dimensions, well beyond police dimensions, humanitarian, political, economic, financial. We're going to be talking about those when we come back from the break. But I want to thank Colette Davidson for joining us from Paris, France. She's Paris correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and she was in Calais, France in June. Colette Davidson, thanks so much for joining us on Point.
Thank you.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, and for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the European migrant crisis. Joining me now from Geneva, Switzerland, is Leonard Doyle. He is spokesman for the International Organization for Migration. Leonard Doyle, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, John, so much.
And from Brussels, Belgium, Ryan Heath joins us. He is senior EU correspondent for Politico Europe. Ryan Heath, thank you as well for joining us on Point.
Hi, John.
Leonard, what's the label you put on this situation? We've been talking about it for the last few minutes as a crisis, and we were looking at it as a, to some degree, humanitarian crisis and as a policing crisis. What label do you put on it?
Well, it's certainly not a migrant crisis because the numbers really are derisively small. What we have is a failure of political leadership crisis mm-hmm. in Europe. And that's resulting in this kind of beggar my neighbor set of policies when they just can't figure out how to deal with a relatively small number of people. It'll probably hit 200,000 people this year trying to come into Europe in an irregular fashion as migrants or refugees. And they can't figure out how to distribute them and share them in a population of over 700 million. So I think that it's a kind of fundamental problem at the basis of the European project that's leading to these kind of flashpoints. I mean, it's not only in Calais. We have them between Italy and France as well. It's not just there.
And when you say that 200,000 is the approximate number and that it's relatively small, let's say we're comparing that to what Jordan and Turkey are dealing with in terms of refugee crisis at the moment from the situation in Syria and Iraq. What is the comparison there?
Well, the numbers there are in the millions, and these are very poor developing countries taking a huge and disproportionate burden of the refugees, essentially refugees from Syria and Iraq. And I think what's important, though, is that because of the hyperbole and the hype in the media about the migrants and about irregular, or as they like to call them, illegal migrants, what's happening is that the refugees are getting lost in the shuffle. So, the politicians in Europe, and split local politics especially, has got itself into a state of hysteria about migrants.
Why did that happen?
I think it's just a race to the bottom in our journalism. We can point fingers at various parts of it in our politics, but it's been a certainty of getting elected and a certainty of getting unelected, your position on the migrant story. So it doesn't pay any dividends for a politician at the moment to stand up and defend, you know, a rational policy on migration, or for that matter, on refugee and asylum. So it just tends to be that there's a degree of kind of popular pub talk, and that leads to a certain hysteria in the media.
Ryan Heath, from Politico Europe, do you agree with that assessment that the situation is being exaggerated in its unsolvability or unaddressability?
Absolutely. I am now aware, just in the last week or so, that the Turkish diplomatic corps have started to really push back to some of the ambassadors, both in Brussels and from EU countries in Turkey, essentially suggesting that if you can't even figure out where to put 60,000 migrants, which is what was roughly agreed by leaders over the course of two summits in April and June, that they're not going to get any sympathy from Turkey, which is dealing with 2 million roughly. Mm-hmm. You've got a country like Lebanon, where literally 25% of the people within its borders now are refugees, mostly from Syria. And it really, I mean, essentially it does put the EU to shame. And I think that there is political pain involved in these decisions, but the way that leaders have handled it, they've essentially allowed that potential pain to accumulate, and they really have only themselves to blame, because a lot of the European institutions have been trying to flag this issue for some time. They themselves don't really have a full solution available, but they are at least trying to address the heart of the matter. And the leaders have just pushed back again and again, because they're driven by a short-term perspective that is actually going to cause them more problems in the long run.
Leonard Doyle, why now then? Why this summer it's blowing up? Does it have to do with the politics of Europe, or does it have to do with the migratory flow?
I think a lot of it is that we're seeing the kind of the delayed fallout from some of the foolishness and the decisions that have been made in terms of wars in the Middle East, and a failure to deal with issues like Boko Haram and the failed policy in Afghanistan. And this is resulting in people being forced out at the point of a very sharp stick in many cases. People are fleeing extremism. Gay people who are getting chucked off buildings by ISIS are getting out of town fast as possible. And these people are showing up on our shores. And of course, coming across the Mediterranean is incredibly perilous. Mm-hmm. We've seen deaths just this weekend, some 14 deaths approximately. People dying of dehydration, for goodness sakes, trying to cross the Mediterranean in flimsy little rubber boats. So it's all leading, I mean, the kind of the lack of generosity of spirit from the continent is leading to tremendous humanitarian fallout. The media are rightly covering it and giving it the attention it deserves, and it's moved right up the political spectrum. So politicians are paying attention to it now, but unfortunately there's a lot of hypocrisy around. There's a lot of kind of failure to address the issue head on, and there's a lot of failure to talk to our populations in sensible ways that it's important to take in refugees on the one hand, and secondly, for example, Germany's population has the lowest birth rate in the world. So how's that country going to remain economic and competitive in the future if you don't take in, you know, duly qualified migrants? So we have a lot of grown-up politics to do that we're failing to do.
We want to listen to Italian Coast Guard officer Arturo Incerti on the point you were making about the risk people are taking to get across the Mediterranean from North Africa. And he works at rescuing stranded migrants who are afloat in the Mediterranean. And here he's speaking to 60 Minutes about the weight he feels personally facing the harsh reality of these migrants on a daily basis.
It's not easy to see every day for months people in the deep sea, like obliged to make this travel because they are escaping from wars, from bombs, from dying, and it's a human experience that is very hard to accept.
Ryan Heath, why doesn't a sentiment like that actually inspire sympathy and open arms in Europe?
Well, I think the at core must be a level of selfishness that I can't quite fathom, but it must exist if we see the sort of dehumanizing portrayals that are coming through in some of the media and in some of the language that even leaders are using. And I think the leaders are aware of the sensitivities here, but can't quite resist pandering to some of that dehumanizing sentiment. And I know that at least one leader, a man called Frans Timmermans, who's one of the vice presidents at the European Commission, he's certainly expressed a lot of worries about that and says that it does remind him of the 1930s, when people will literally worry more about Cecil the Lion, which I agree is a tragedy, or whether there will be oranges on the supermarket shelves tomorrow, more than they worry about whether people are being thrown off trains or dying in rubber boats in the Mediterranean. And so I think once you use vague terms and you start dehumanizing the situation, it's easier to push it out of your mind or to consider it somebody else's problem rather than people like yourself who are literally just trying to avoid being killed or living a life of suffering.
Well, last week we heard British Prime Minister David Cameron criticized for calling the migrants a swarm.
Look, this is very testing, I accept that, because you've got a swarm of people coming across the Mediterranean, seeking a better life, wanting to come to Britain, because Britain has got jobs, it's got a growing economy, it's an incredible place to live, but we need to protect our borders by working hand in glove with our neighbours, the French.
Leonard Doyle, what grade do you give Prime Minister Cameron in that remark? On the one hand, he was saying, yes, they are seeking a better life. They want to come because Britain's an incredible place and it's a growing economy, sort of to Ryan Heath's point, they're like us. And then he says, but we need to protect our borders by working hand in glove with our neighbors, the French, which sounds like a push away. What do you make of what he's been saying?
Well, he's a political leader dealing with, you know, the summer tourist traffic, and there's lots of his constituents and voters and what have you are spending hours and hours in traffic trying to get away on their short little 2-week break. So there is obvious sympathy with them. Listening to BBC reports this morning about restaurant owners, etc., in Calais, they have no customers because all their British customers come over to buy cheaper booze are not there. So there's clearly, you know, there's plenty to be sympathetic with. There's plenty of issues, important issues. But I think what's happening is there's a confusion between the issue of queue jumpers or economic migrants, if you will, and those who are genuinely in need of protection. And the what we're hearing about the people who are present in the jungle, as it's called in Calais, is that they are from Sudan. They're fleeing, getting pushed into militias. They're from Afghanistan. They're from Eritrea, a police state. They're from Syria. They're from places where, by any standards, they're deserving of asylum, or at least a hearing on asylum. So the idea that they're caught in this choke point and putting their lives at risk, and remember, many of them are unaccompanied minors as well, is really doesn't stand in good stead for Britain's, you know, incredibly generous humanitarian reputation.
We want to invite our listeners into the conversation, and let's begin by bringing in Elaine from Omaha, Nebraska. Elaine, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, John, and thank you for the multifaceted presentation that you always make on this program. What I want to say is that America and the Western European countries have always benefited from the labor and the resources of the colonial countries that they, you know, invaded years ago. And now we're reaping the harvest in the Middle East and in Africa of that colonialism. So I think the least we can do is share our wealth and put more of the money that we spend on war into solving these humanitarian problems, you know, into conflict resolution, into teaching tolerance. There's so many ways that we know to resolve conflict between nations and between groups of people inside nations that are in conflict. So if, you know, the United States this next year has budgeted 45% of our income to go to military causes, past and present. You know, the debt on past wars and the commitments to the present. So if we would spend even a fraction of that money on humanitarian aid, I don't think we'd have such a big refugee problem.
All right, Elaine, thanks for your question, for your point. And I want to bring it to Ryan Heath in terms of European spending on putting money toward addressing this issue at the moment. Where is popular sentiment on that?
It's an extremely slim amount of money, and it's an extremely low level of support. We literally have a situation now where some members of the European Parliament have joined vigilante squads to try and hunt out people who have made it through the tunnel before they can claim anything.
Can you back that up? You said members of the Parliament are joining vigilante squads?
Yes, a man called Mike Hookham, today was tweeting and including photographs of people that he was finding in and around the port areas of the channel and claiming victory like it was sort of a hunting spoil that he was finding and turning in illegals, as he called them, which is one of the popular terms. And I think things are getting a little bit out of control when you're held up as a hero by your constituents or by the media when you're acting in that way, effectively outside of the law. This wasn't you turning in somebody who turned up in your back garden. This is effectively you going out and chasing down people who clearly are doing it for some form of reason, whether it's the legal official route or not. It's not being done for a matter of fun. People aren't doing this for fun, basically. I think that the EU is trying at some level to mitigate the lack of action at a national level. But, for instance, we saw €6 million only, so around about $7 million, announced today in extra humanitarian assistance to Libya. And frankly, that's peanuts. We saw already the defunding of the main search and rescue operation that was being conducted by the Italians, by a joint naval task force. And that's been largely put back in place now. But again, it was funded with very small amounts of money. And you compare that to a government like Australia, which has had a very draconian approach to how it deals with sea-based arrivals of illegal immigrants or asylum seekers. But what you can say is that it's a very clear system. They have invested in propaganda in the source countries to say, we're not going to welcome you, so please don't risk your life coming. They invested in detention and processing centres, which I think were under very harsh conditions in sometimes very extreme locations like deserts and faraway islands. Mm-hmm. But at the very least, they had a grip on the situation and people had some form of certainty and predictability about what was going on. And it's very odd to see what the French have done now, creating this sort of no man's land in Calais, where they aren't really identifying or fingerprinting or housing or attempting to send back a lot of those people
who
are there.
Why are they so behind on this?
That's something I just simply don't understand at the moment. They're clearly now doing more work with the UK authorities. I think there is a little bit within the thought process of let's just shift these people on to the next destination. You see that in Greece, which obviously is in a very difficult economic situation, doesn't have the resources to really handle everyone passing through its borders. The Italians are certainly allowing some people to go further north because they think they've done their fair bit rescuing everybody or as many as they can in the ocean. Hungary
But does Italy have a point in that sense? Is Italy doing more than its share?
They're the country I have the most sympathy with if I look across the whole scene because clearly they are the ones dealing with most of the sea-based arrivals, and essentially the other countries left them for dead. You had a quota proposal coming forward a few months ago for European leaders to consider. So you have the European Commission. Its job is to defend the general European interest. It came up with a proposal. Some of these countries had to accept fewer than 50 asylum seekers. So fewer than 50, sometimes only 100, 150 people under this quota plan. And those leaders would not agree to accept those small numbers. So I do feel sympathy for Italy being left to carry the can.
Leonard Doyle, we only have a minute before we go to break, but we all expect these days Germany to lead. Is Germany leading at all?
Well, Germany's doing an extraordinary job, as is Sweden, in taking in the largest number of refugees and indeed in a very mature and uncomplaining way, by and large. We can come back to it perhaps, but I will really take issue with what's been said about Australia, because that is very much a sui generis, unique approach, because they're living at the bottom of the planet. They can do their policy, they can get away with it, but it's not possible in Europe, where the continent is surrounded by so many other countries. There are so many different ways into the continent. The idea that we have a naval flotilla just pushing boats back to developing countries and letting people fend for themselves, I don't think would be acceptable by any means.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we are talking about the confrontation in Europe over migrants this summer, the Mediterranean, Calais, France, Hungary, and more places. We're talking with Leonard Doyle. He is spokesman for the International Organization for Migration, and Ryan Heath. He is senior EU correspondent for Politico Europe. We're hearing from a lot of you already on Twitter, on Facebook, and on our website, including, I'll read a couple of comments that have come in. This is from Ari in Vermont. He says, when these people starve and freeze to death and become radicalized while being mistreated in places like Calais, who will take the blame when that happens? AC writes in, I don't think that's entirely fair. It's a political leadership in their countries. Those countries should be put to task. The entire planet cannot live in a few places all at once. That's just foolish to think that's possible. Let's bring in Kate, who's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Kate, welcome to On Point.
Hi, guys. Thank you. I was just wondering if the panel here might be able to comment on any potential kind of racial issues that are associated with the resistance here, and if the kind of outcry against kind of refugees coming from, you know, predominantly African nations to European nations would be so strong if they were refugees that were not, you know, African or not black, and if that plays any role here.
Interesting question. Leonard Doyle, what about that? Is there a race element here?
Well, undoubtedly, there are cultural issues. We've heard this from the Hungarian leadership, where they've made very overt and indeed xenophobic statements about the type of people who are coming over the border. I think a lot of it is a kind of cultural discomfort, and some of it undoubtedly comes from what they're seeing and hearing that's happening in the wars in Syria and Iraq, and the various acts of terrorism that have happened from extremists, from Islamic extremists, which are, you know, not that infrequent, and Europeans are victims of them all the time. I think that's getting mixed up in people's minds with a sense of lack of security, insecurity following the economic turndown of recent years. People are afraid for themselves, they're afraid for their economic security. But at the end of the day, let's not forget that they've gone through this many times, and Europe is getting more used to migrants, far more so than it has been in the past. There was a time when Irish immigrants in London were not welcome. That's obviously changed hugely. And so I think there's a maturation aspect to this as well. But there you are.
Well, you mentioned cultural xenophobia coming from Hungary, and we have a speech last week that Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban gave, in which he condemned the migrants moving into Europe and arguing total closure of all doors across the board because, he said, of terrorism risks. I'm going to tell you what he's saying. He's saying it is obvious that we simply cannot filter out hostile terrorists from this enormous crowd. Our answer is clear. We would like to preserve Europe for Europeans. Ryan, it sounds like he's sending several messages at once. One is about keeping Europe for Europeans. The other is that these people are terrorists. And he's also authorized, and I believe Hungary has already begun constructing a wall against along its softest border. It's going to cost millions of dollars, and it's going to be, you know, 12 feet high. To keep people from crossing from Serbia into Hungary. And the reason I'm mentioning that is that seems like a great deal more, given the cost, than just a mere political gesture to keep his constituents happy. That sounds like true conviction on his part.
Yes, I think that's right. And they've actually fast-tracked the building of that border, and they now claim that it will be finished by the end of August, ahead of the original November schedule. So that would be quite extraordinary if that did take place.
How is that playing? I'm just thinking in terms of Europe, a place that's so proud of having taken down borders and literally removed a wall in its heart. How does it play to be building walls again in Europe?
I think it obviously looks very bad, but Europe's facing a lot of existential questions right now, as you see from all of the dramas around Greece, for example. And so migration is certainly high up on that list, and I think the kind of dark horse, the one that won't go away from that list, but it's not necessarily even the most pressing issue that a lot of European leaders find themselves facing. And so the point made already around the effects of the economic crisis, I think, is a very real one. There's a lot of economic insecurity. People don't feel like they have as many opportunities as they need to provide for their families or to get a step ahead or do as well as their parents did. But I think that Europe is actually also surprisingly conservative when it comes to matters of race and culture. As someone who's lived in Europe now for 12 years but grew up in Australia, for example, for me, Europeans, I think, are a little bit naive about the level of racism that exists in their society. They like to look down on Americans as being more racist, for example, but they are very conservative in relation to who they consider to be of their nationality. You can't ever really be truly German, to give one example, unless you have German or what is considered German blood. To be naturalized doesn't quite make you an equal first-class German citizen. I know that a lot of Polish people feel the same way. Nicolas Sarkozy, the former French president, has even started to backtrack on some of his previous remarks, which is that to be born in France makes you French. And now he's gone a little bit soft on that matter because he's trying to play to that more right-wing audience. And so I think you see some of those attitudes coming through or being reflected by leaders, because these issues might have been tackled at a legal level in terms of equality, but never really truly tackled at a cultural level. And it's in tough times, tough economic times, times when people are desperately trying to cling to office, when you start to see all those unresolved problems bubbling to the surface.
Let's bring in Brad from Omaha, Nebraska. Brad, welcome to On Point.
Yes, thank you, John. Sorry about that. One issue that I'm hearing and that was raised earlier was that is this a world problem or is this a European problem? And from the United States perspective, it's definitely a world problem. But we in the United States have been dealing with this type of issue.
Brad, I apologize that we're taking you off. It's because your phone line is difficult to understand. If you can try to call back on a landline or with a better connection, we will try to get you on because we would like to hear what you have to say. Leonard Doyle, earlier Ryan Heath was making the point that Australia at least has a policy, at least has a plan and an approach, harsh as it may be, and I don't think he was embracing it, but he was saying at least they've figured out what they're going to do, and you wanted to take issue with that, and I wanted to give you your chance now.
Well, I think it's important because the European Union has gone to study it. For example, lots of people are tempted by it, and they think, oh, that's a clear way of doing it. But we must remember that Australia is very, very far away. It has one big neighbour, Indonesia, and it has close relations with it, and it's pushing boats back to Indonesia. One could not replicate that in a thousand years in Europe. There are just so many breakpoints, so many ways that people can get across, whether it's on land borders or whether it's on sea, whether it's from Morocco to Spain or Libya to Lampedusa or Turkey to Greece. So I think it's kind of a false analogy in that sense. It sounds neat, and I'm not suggesting Ryan was endorsing it, but it sounds clear and neat, but it's also the wrong way of looking at the problem. At the end of the day, these are people who are entitled to asylum. The idea that we build a better fence and keep them all out there isn't going to solve that issue.
Let's bring in Tony from Largemont, New York. Tony, welcome to On Point.
Yes, I lived in Germany for some years near a center where they would put in all the asylum seekers. And one day, it was always very cut off. You'd see them when you were going by on the train. You'd see the windows. They'd kind of provisionally made up curtains, and you'd always saw these kind of naked, naked light bulbs. But one time they had an open day so that the local community could come in and see what's going on there. And I just happened to be walking by, and I went in. And my impression was it was like a kind of a campus, and there were a lot of families with little children. There were people dancing. They had a food festival. There were also a lot of young men standing around looking like they had nothing to do and also that they were very worried. My ultimate impression was that, at least in Germany, when they come in, they're structurally separated, but they're well taken care of. I talked to the Wacher there, the guy who was, the security guy, who seemed on very friendly terms with all of them, and he said they come and then most of them go back, meaning most of them are sent back en masse. So they go through this long process, and once again, the gentleman speaking, God bless him, but I wonder he's being paid to take this point of view that all the Europeans are becoming reactionary against this group of asylum seekers. But from what I saw, they're actually, at least as far as Germany is concerned, extremely well taken care of. But they are also separated structurally, and ultimately I have the impression that most of them went back.
All right. Thanks very much for your call, Tony. Leonard Doyle, you mentioned, used the phrase a few minutes ago that the migrants are entitled to asylum. And Tony
let's just clarify it. I'm saying people who are seeking asylum are entitled to a hearing, and many of those we see coming through are indeed, on the face of it, genuine asylum seekers. Many more, of course, are economic migrants. Just to speak directly to the point of your caller, which is particularly interesting, his insights into the center. I mean, it is also the case that, you know, groups or countries or areas where there's really no direct threat to people's lives or livelihoods or belief systems, quite often, like, they just get a kind of a rush of blood to the head and decide they want to go to Europe. This has happened in Kosovo. It's been a big problem for Kosovo because many of the young people have been selling whatever few assets they have, a motor car, you know, borrowing money left and right, in the belief and hope that if they get to Germany, everything will be so much better. In fact, it's not. They're turned around on a fast-track process, and they end up going back with their tails between their legs, impoverished. So undoubtedly, there are a lot of queue jumpers, if you like, who do get processed and sent back in this way. Mm-hmm. But we were talking specifically about the people in Calais, and if you listen carefully to the reports, they talk about Sudanese, Eritreans, Afghanis, Syrians. Now, on the face of it, these people are entitled to asylum hearings.
Because of where they're coming from.
Precisely. They're coming from places where there's not a lot of nice things happening. And for them to risk their life and limb to get this far, I mean, one can only imagine what they've been going through.
Let's bring in Dave from Hartford, Connecticut. Dave, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Good show today.
Oh, thank you.
I just want to say that you know, without borders, you don't have a country. And most countries have a process you're supposed to follow to get into that country, and that does not involve taking rubber rafts to the shore. And I appreciate the sympathy, and I also appreciate that a lot of this is caused by the disastrous intervention in Libya that caused all this mess that has occurred. Mm-hmm. But at some point, you just have to draw a line and say, you know, this is our country, this is how you come in, and if you can't follow those rules, then we can't keep you. And that's sort of what needs to be done in these circumstances. And I think if that started happening, there would be less people coming across because they know they'd just be turned back.
Dave, thanks for your call. And I think you're probably touching on something that a lot of our listeners are thinking is number one, they can understand the plight. They can understand absolutely the desire to want to reach Britain or any place in Europe as compared to a war-torn situation where their lives are in danger. And yet there is this sense of how much room in the rowboat and what about the rules? And, you know, I want to take that question to you, Ryan Heath, and I know that you're a journalist and probably not given to expressing your opinion, but maybe you can put this in terms of how the Europeans are processing this issue. Balancing sympathy on the one hand with the sense of wanting to have an orderly process on the other.
Well, in a sense, it actually leads us to somewhat the worst of both worlds, because I think Leonard's right. I mean, Europeans would be horrified at the idea of locking these asylum seekers or even these illegal migrants up in some kind of desert or island prison camp. Like the concept of it would be deeply shocking. But because they aren't willing to come up with some other stronger system, whether that's stronger in accepting people or stronger in sending them back, you end up in that weird zone now where effectively all of that misery is continued via the back door. And so I think that someone has to step up and show leadership. And I think while many of those people will clearly be accepted as asylum seekers if they get a fair hearing, what isn't really fair is for an individual country like the UK, because it's home to English language speakers and its government somewhat foolishly keeps advertising what a great economy it has. Mm-hmm. It's not really fair that people can just jump through five or six different countries and then decide that England is where they want to apply for asylum. That doesn't mean that the United Kingdom shouldn't take some kind of fair share of those asylum seekers who are approved through a clear and fair system. But it does point to the fact that you need some kind of EU-wide joint action. And I guess as a journalist, where I'm reluctant to go further is to say, where do I draw those lines around what is just and fair and further necessary action. But it seems very clear that you won't get a result that satisfies anybody, or at least clarifies the situation, unless there is some kind of joint action. And the one lesson that can be taken from the Australian experience, whatever one thinks of the policy choices made there, is even to turn around a few thousand people or to process a few thousand people in those detention centres, it's cost billions of dollars, US dollars, over the course of a decade. And so the fact that the numbers are greater in Europe really demonstrates that Europe is not properly investing in this situation. And I hate to think what is going to rain down upon those European leaders if a country like Lebanon does explode, or if Turkey decides it's not going to put up with 2 million people any longer. They won't know what's hit them. And that's going to be a very difficult situation for everybody if they fail to resolve this situation before that kind of downpour emerges.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you for joining us in this hour and actually, I would say, very usefully clarifying the true dimensions of this thing for us as it's being reported on this side of the ocean. It's a massive wave and a crisis of untold proportions, and you've put it in a totally new perspective for us. I've learned from that, and I know I'm not going to see this story the same way again. So I want to thank you both. Leonard Doyle, spokesman for the International Organization for Migration, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much to you and your callers and my fellow guest.
And Ryan Heath, your fellow guest, senior EU correspondent for Politico Europe. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can join this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, tough new carbon restrictions, what the president is proposing, Germany's already doing. Would the American people buy into this? I'm John Donvan, and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.